Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine on this blustery, late winter, early spring day. Yep, Green Zine here at WFVRLP in South Royalton, Vermont. We're going to do the underwriters. Henry is on hold. We'll be bringing him into the mix, but we do want to thank the folks that keep Green Zine on the air each and every week, Thursdays, from 11 a.m. until noon. And they include the Yes We Can Collective. Yeah, we're in-house collecting a lot of cans, and I think we're going to get to that point where it's worth a $150 underwriting credit. Also, Wit and Grit, a breakfast and lunch establishment in Randolph, Vermont. The First Branch Coffee Company. Solarfest happening over in Brandon, Vermont. A full slate of environmental educational workshops happening and a whole lot of great music from both Vermont and from further away. Coming up on August 7th, 8th, and 9th. The Upper Pass Beer Company also helping us out. Daniel Leibowitz, Bail, Building a Local Economy. Check out their activities at bailvt.org. Solaflect and Tom Wells and his business, Royal Trail Works. Well, we're going to start a little bit different today. Yeah, get on board, and we'll tell you why after we listen to a little bit of The Who and Magic Bus.
Takes me to you. I'm so nervous, I just sit and smile. Your house is only another mile. Thank you, driver, for getting me here. You'll be an inspector, have no fear. Every day, just to drive to my baby. Throw them 10 sixpence each day, 'cause I drive my baby every way.
Yeah, there they are, the four from England and Magic Bus. Hey, before I bring up Henry, because he's probably scratching his head right now, don't know if he got that album when it came out. Playing that in honor, well, at least to recognize a new electric school bus. Yeah, pretty magical over there in Stratford. This taken from today's Herald, the White River Valley Herald. You can find the story. It's very brief on page A6. And there's Will Cooney. He's the bus driver. And John Freitag writing the story. There is a new full-size electric bus transporting those kids over at the Newton School in Stratford. Back in 2022, the White River Valley Supervisory Union was a recipient of an Environmental Protection Agency. Boy, those were back in the days. Grant of $1.185 million for the replacement of three of the diesel buses used in the Supervisory Union. Cost of the buses was fully covered by the grant and also provided $20,000 for each charging station. Superintendent Jamie Canarney of the Supervisory Union is currently negotiating a reduction from the bus contractor due to the arrival of the electric buses, which are owned by the Supervisory Union. Nice. School bus driver Will Cooney likes the quieter ride and better power of the electric bus. Yeah. Punch it. Besides the Newton Elementary School routes, Cooney also takes students to the Hartford Vocational and Tech Center. Henry, do you want to get a ride on that electric school bus?
You know, I visited with a UVM campus bus driver who was driving an electric bus here on the campus. They don't have a lot. They have one or two, many diesel ones. But he said he loved it. And I know my kids, when they got off the bus after an hour bus ride to get home at the end of the school day in Tunbridge, were always a little blurry-eyed and dizzy by the exhaust fumes from their bus. And so that electric bus not only is not burning fossil fuel, but it's also not killing our kids. So,
yeah, that's pretty important.
Good territory to be getting into. And yes, they're pricey right now, but things will get cheaper, and if we don't buy any, they won't get cheaper. So it's part of the building process to move to electric.
It is indeed. So we have a jam-packed show here on Green Zine with Henry and myself. We've got 7 minutes into the show. Why don't you give a brief overview? And Henry, your link was not correct for the Junkos, but I did look it up on another device. I'm not sure it's the one you chose, but it is about Junkos. So I am ready with Letter to a Dark-Eyed Junko when you are.
Okay, well, let's just listen to it. That'd be great. Or here, let me give a flow of the show.
Okay, yeah, let's do that first.
Yeah, so let me just say that we're going to start off with our bird note, and then we're going to jump into some kind of political and negative stuff, because I've had a personal experience that makes me want to talk about it.
Yep.
And then we're going to come back and look at some more positive stuff after that, and our guest will be getting into author of Mother Creature Kin, What Have We Learned from Nature's Mothering in Time Unraveling. And that's a spiritual note as well as a natural note. And then we'll also get into another book that is really emphasizing what happens when you tap into the abundance thinking rather than the scarcity thinking that we seem to be stuck in so heavily right now. And more bits and pieces after that, things you can do and so forth.
And we will talk about Earth Day is coming up really soon here on the 22nd, so we'll have a little bit of some Earth Day tips for you before the end of the show. But right now I'm going to bring you down in the mix there, Henry, and if this all works properly, we're going to hear a letter to a dark-eyed junco as part of today's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. I'm J. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist, naturalist, and writer, and this is a note I've written to a bird I love. Dear Snowbird, Junko, yes, you with the dark eyes, dark-eyed Junko. Yes, you are a Junko to most, but persistently in my memory, you're a snowbird. My grandmother, Mamatha, would agree, then toss you and all the other sparrows a handful of grits. She'd shower the frosty ground with that crushed to almost dust corn right from the bag. There'd be no butter or melty cheese on top of the heaping hot plate of cooked grits she didn't give you. That steamy meal she'd toss to me. I know it would have been a bit much for you anyway. You're more of an al fresco bird. I still see you scratching for seeds in my South Carolina home now, like you did back then. I know that the warming world makes it harder than ever to claim snow in your name, but you'll always be the sparrow in a tuxedo, little Junco. I'll expect you again when the leaves are past falling and the limbs almost bare. How about we just keep the chilly nickname between us, okay? You melt me, Drew.
Gulls are a great group of birds to get to know. They're easy to find and fun to watch. But gull identification can be tricky, even for experienced birders. Don't panic. Bird Academy is here to help with a self-paced, fully online course that will help make gull ID a breeze. Instructor and world-renowned ornithologist Kevin McGowan will help you focus in on the most important plumages and variations to know, taking into account season and age for all commonly occurring gulls in North America. With interactive practice exercises for every species, you'll be naming gulls with ease in no time. Find this course at academy.allaboutbirds.org. BirdNote listeners get an extra 30% off the course price with the code BirdNoteGull. That's all one word, BirdNoteGull. Use the BirdNoteGull code at checkout when you visit academy.allaboutbirds.org.
Well, I wasn't really ready for that potential call to action there, but that's okay. Always curious about gulls. I'm going to be spending some time with gulls. I didn't know that was folded into the Junco piece, but hey, it's live radio. Nope. We like doing live radio.
It's live radio, and it's good to let those people have a little bit of say since they produce such marvelous little notes that we can use.
They do, indeed.
So I picked out the Junco because we had about 30 of them on our lawn, and they were pecking around, and I looked them up to see. They've been here all winter. They've hung around there, so that's the snow kind of piece. And our Juncos are actually a variant on dark-eyed Juncos. They are slate-colored Juncos, and they are pretty much what we have here in Vermont. But I had a quick look and discovered, I wondered whether they were starting to nest because they were picking bugs and things out of the dead lawn, and discovered that no, they aren't nesting yet. They're going to move into the conifer forest and higher ground and do their nesting there. And this is just kind of fattening up time. So, So we'll leave that as it is, but they are very friendly, sociable birds and very busy. So I wanted to get into last week we talked about going to the hands-off rally with maybe 10 to 15,000 people in Montpelier that I went to. And there were many, many, many points that were being encouraged that we should correct. And some of them were the Palestinian issues and what ICE is doing. And I have a friend who is part of our glider club, and I consider him a personal friend. And it's Mosen, who was just scooped up by ICE and spirited away on Monday of this week. And he was scheduled to show up at the immigration office in Colchester to get his final test for citizenship. He's been in the country on a green card for 10 plus years, and this was his last step to being made an official U.S. citizen. And he saw that as he's going to Colombia. He was instrumental in forming the rallies there, and it was a gut punch to me to have him just get scooped up and carted away. And I think we should go to that that news clip that I put in there. So a friend of his, Christopher Joseph Hilades, accompanied him to ICE, what shouldn't be ICE, the naturalization office in Colchester, Vermont. And he is, this person is a social studies teacher at Hanover High School, lives in Vershire, is the chief high bailiff of Orange County. He is a very educated person with both religious and other degrees, has studied politics and religion, and is a very broad-minded person. Anyway, so let's listen to that clip.
Okay, I think I've got it lined up. Yep, and the subtitle to this is Palestinian Activists Expecting a U.S. Citizenship Interview Arrested by ICE. You're listening to Green Zine here, Royalton Community Radio.
Today, Mohsen had a appointment for an interview to complete his and finalize his steps for naturalization. So he is a green card holder. He's a permanent resident of the United States. Even though we had reason to believe and suspicion that he would be arrested by ICE and Homeland Security at this appointment. So Mohsen, being a lawful permanent resident, came to this interview that was slated for 11 o'clock this morning. By 12 o'clock, he was in handcuffs, and at 12:03, he was brought outside the building, where he was put into a unmarked vehicle with Vermont license plates and taken away in a convoy. We have reason to believe that he was detained for the same reason that Mahmoud was detained at, you know, as well. And all these Columbia students and all these other students, including Ozturk at Tufts University, just for exercising their constitutional rights and standing up for Palestine. That's why we believe that they were detained, and they're being targeted in a vicious campaign online and with the administration's support, the Trump administration's support, to get rid of these students who have divergent viewpoints than the administration. Mohsen has always been at the forefront of peace and really strengthening ties between the Jewish, Muslim, Christian communities, between Palestinians and Israelis. And he's always been a very big advocate for reconciliation, for dialogue, for bridge building in any capacity. We knew that this kind of meeting, this interview, for his naturalization that would have put him back in government proximity would have been the perfect opportunity for them to abduct him. And that's exactly what happened.
That is exactly what happened, Henry. And you were up that way.
Yes. And I went to last night. I went to the rally at the state prison where we think he's still being held. He has a court order to stop the feds or the ICE from taking him out of Vermont, but who knows whether that's being followed. And so I went to a rally with maybe a mile of cars parked on the blacktop by the state corrections prison in St. Albans, and it was cold and windy and raining. And there was definitely a Palestinian bent to that, but the handmade signs that were there were all the pushback things, the things that we are just having our democracy destroyed. And they weren't anti-Jewish. I don't think I saw a single anti-Jewish sign. I saw signs for stopping the genocide. So that's as close as it got to an anti-Jewish sign that I saw. And I will copy out some of those signs. I just took a few pictures, and I'll copy them out and put them in our notes. They aren't there yet. I have to take some work to do that.
Yep.
There is also an interview which you can review from Becca Blanche. All of our people in the U.S. Congress are pushing back together, and even the governor has weighed in and said, you can't deport people without having them have a hearing. You need to have real reason for scooping people up and sending them off. So there's also a link, a really important listen for Heather Cox Richards, and the link for that, it explores other things. The first colonizers of America coming here to extract wealth from America, and how that greed factor is now overlooked. Greed is kind of an underlying rot that's in our system, and they explore that pretty thoroughly.
I'm not sure how underlying it is. I think it's above,
well, it's
above ground.
We're not focused on it. We're focused on racism and sexism and the greed goes, you know, a little bit. I mean, the whole idea of a corporation is to maximize profit, and unchecked, that's what they do, and they do it very efficiently. And that's what the first people from Europe coming to the United States were doing. They were here to extract wealth and return that wealth to the people who funded their trade.
Yeah, I'll look forward to hearing
a corporate effort.
So that's a Substack piece I see. Once again, you'll be putting it at the links, Heather Cox Richards. Should be a pretty good discussion. Here comes the Southbounder, Henry. You might hear it in the background.
And on for our guest. I will get our guest, who is Chelsea Scudder, who is the author of Mother, Creature, Kin, and What We Learn from Nature, Mothers in Time Unraveling.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the discussion. And she's checking in from the road, but she now lives in Rochester, Vermont. So Henry and Chelsea will be rejoining us in just a moment. I'm going to bring up a little music that has a Vermont connection. It's a Canadian group called The Fretless, but one of the players is from Pomfret, Vermont. Going to cite a letter I mentioned, and most of you are aware of this. If you're listening to this show, you know that Earth Day is coming right up, and someone who's a regular listener to the show has written a rather insightful letter to the editor of today's Herald, the April 17th issue, Kathy Hassey. Earth Day is April 22nd, and Hassey writes, I was in elementary school for the first Earth Day in 1970. Our teachers asked us to engage parents. Mom already cleaned with baking soda and white vinegar, and Dad agreed to stop using chemicals in the yard. Good job. We were taught reduce, reuse, recycle. If only I truly practiced this these past 50 years, our planet would be healthier and I would have much less stuff and more money. Aging and slowing down means I notice now what I'm using, while in earlier years I was moving too fast to notice. May this senior citizen offer suggestions while remaining open to your ideas. Number one, conserve. Using less can be as simple as driving the speed limit, combining road trips, and shorter showers. Two, stop idling. It's bad for the engine and bad for all our health. Vermont's limited vehicle idling law was enacted back in 2013. It restricts idling to 5 minutes in any 60-minute period. you know if you drive an accepted vehicle like an ambulance. I have heard arresting stories from people talking to people. An elderly man who idles for hours using Wi-Fi outside a library shared that his house is too hot and he's unable to walk into the library, which has air conditioning. Not thinking about the pollution at this point, but rather the baby. All right, another story there. Join local groups like the White River Partnership for activities like the River Cleanup coming up on Greenup Day. That's May 3rd, and there'll be another one in September. It's super fun and gratifying to clean up, and a picnic usually follows. Yeah, I think I went to that picnic one year. Practice pack it in, bag it out. Familiar to hikers and hunters and done at our state parks. Take your own litter home and dispose of properly. Our small communities are challenged, emptying trash containers, plus critters love litter and dive in, leaving additional eyesores. Please consider these. I realize we all love our earth in different ways. Also on the same page, I won't read this one to you, but on page B2 of the Herald, an interesting piece from Stephen Leslie called The Preservation of the World, and it has a lot to do with a House bill that's been introduced, and it's House Bill 276, and it's called the Vermont Climate Resilience and State Wildlands Act. You might want to read about that bill and contact your local representative. All right, I'm going to bring this music down, but not all the way, but I think maybe Henry's had some luck reaching our guest. Are we all connected out there, Henry and Chelsea?
We are here.
Excellent.
I have Chelsea Scooter with me on the line, and we're looking forward to some more positive sides to things. So welcome to Green Zine.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, good morning, Chelsea. Yeah. Are you feeling pretty positive today? I'm not sure if you're speaking to us from Rochester, your new hometown, or whether you're on the road somewhere else today.
Yes, I'm in one of my first hometowns. I'm in Norman, Oklahoma today. And
whoa.
Yes, so I'm a ways away, but there's sun shining and a nice breeze, so I'm doing good today.
Okay, but make sure you come back to Vermont.
So were you born there?
I was born in Nebraska, and we moved here when I was 3 years old, so, and then I was here until I was 25, so I spent those formative years here in Oklahoma, yeah.
Are you in prairie? Were you living in prairie land and open skies and...
Nebraska time, my very earliest years, we were out in the Sand Hills Prairie in northwestern Nebraska, where my dad was, we were living on a nature conservancy prairie preserve, where my dad was doing his prairie research, and then grew up after that, we came down here to Norman, which is kind of a Midwestern college town, a little more urban, and so we were a little,
Wow. All right. Well, that's a different flavor than Vermont. We need to we need to have contact with other parts of the country and the values of those natural landscapes as well. We get very thinking that lots of rainfall and whatever we have here in Vermont is the ideal place, and don't pay attention enough to the rest of the world.
Yes, it's beautiful out here.
So you have written a book, Mother Creature Kin, What We Learn from Nature's Mothers in Time Unraveling. Tell us a little bit about what brought you to do this, and maybe what your goals were in tackling this subject.
Yeah, thank you so much. So, I had several. Well, I guess what brought me to write this book was I had been writing about this intersection of spirituality and ecology for a number of years when my daughter arrived in the world. And so I had different people really around the world considering what it means to be in deep relationship to place and to their local ecosystems and sort of other than human beings. And so I'd spent a lot of time sort of thinking about how other people were doing that work. And when my daughter arrived right in the middle of the pandemic, I had this sense that it was time for me to start articulating my own sort of ideas around spiritual ecology. And now that I had this other being I was going to be raising, and in a time that was feeling very precarious, wanting to think about what it means to take care of our children and to take care of our local places and our communities. And so that was what brought me to write the book. And then, yeah, in writing, I sort of wove two threads around mothering. One was just sort of thinking about mothering as mothering my daughter, thinking about what it means to ensure that she has a healthy, sustainable future on this planet. And then the other was thinking about how mothering can also be a wider orientation and sort of a framework of thinking about how anyone of us, whether or not we're mothers, whether or not we're parents, can be a person who gives deep care and attention to the beings around them. And so I came up with this idea of what it means to pursue sort of an ecological motherhood, which is much sort of a shared communal responsibility to place, that asks us how we can be nurturing and supporting both human life and the more than human life that we're sharing our places with.
Hmm. Yes. So have you gotten into, I have to admit that I have not read your book or even gotten very far into it in terms of research, but have you looked at, do you consider in the book, the nature of abundance, that when you are working with nature to have nature thrive, that life becomes more abundant? Or is it mostly from a spiritual point of view that you all of a sudden start feeling like you are in a better place?
Yes, really both of those things. I do a lot of thinking about how when we encounter nature in the living world, in terms of my own sense of the sacred or my own ideas around spirituality, that is a place where any of us can come into a sense of encountering something greater than ourselves, and a sense that we are not just individuals, but we're really interconnected into these ecosystems we share our world with, you know, really in literal ways, you know, just in terms of these trees right out your window are making the air you're breathing. And we, of course, need healthy water and healthy soil. And also those places give us, and there's all kinds of scientific studies backing up that being outdoors gives us resiliency and gives us things for our mental and our spiritual and our emotional health, gives us resources for those things. And so, yeah, throughout the book, I look at different species and ecosystems. One example is just some forest. We have about 20 acres up in Johnson, Vermont, and I do some thinking about what we can learn from sort of trees as existing in a healthy, thriving community, and absolutely that sense of abundance of our forests in Vermont and how we can be participating in that and get a reciprocal sense of sort of taking care of our landscapes, and in turn our landscapes really also take care of us.
Yeah, I like that reciprocity that you bring up in the book, and I'm just looking at a brief overview. I have also, but I think I'm going to be getting the book soon. Could we go back a little bit? You know, obviously, your spirituality plays an important role in your philosophy of life and in writing this book. I think one thing that we didn't mention, and I'd like to drop back in time, I believe I read in your bio that maybe you attended the Harvard Divinity School. Is that correct?
That's right, yes.
And can I ask you, during that time, and I don't know how long ago that was, were you thinking as much then as you do now about the surrounding environment and future generations and what the impact could be? Or is that something that sort of came after, or were they sort of hand in hand?
Yes, great question. So when I was at Harvard Divinity School, I was studying comparative religion, and at that time I was thinking more about conflict resolution and how we can work within different frameworks of faith to find common ground with people who are experiencing discord or conflict. And so that was my intention while I was at HDS. And it wasn't until after I had graduated that I had sort of returned to my sort of foundational upbringing in terms of having this deep respect for the earth and for landscapes that came to me through my parents that I'd always had. And then it was after I graduated that I started actively looking for ways to weave those two things together.
Very interesting.
So, and are you continuing to write? Are you doing any ministry? How are you interacting with the community, if you are, in Rochester?
So we moved to Rochester just about a year ago, coming up on a year, and we have, it's been wonderful to be there. The community, part of why we moved there was because my husband and I had both been through that town and spent some time there, and we had a sense of what just a tight-knit and engaged community it was. And so we have been, I got to do a book event at Rochester Library last week and had a wonderful conversation, and a lot of our work there, I'm feeling, I think, really fortunate that as this book comes into the world, we're also settling into this new place and sort of figuring out ways to really live out what this book is about and what it's asking us to do in terms of being committed to a place, understanding our local ecosystems, understanding, all the complexities of this local human community, and sort of actively figuring out how we can be more involved in that. And so, a few things where I'm working on getting my prescribed fire certification so I can help with some local landscape restoration. And we're teaching our daughter, who's 4, about just with the plants that are growing around us. So we're going to put in a pollinator garden this spring. And so, it's actually just been such a gift to start sort of living out this book in our new home.
Yeah, I'm going to just segue into when you meant, I was going to ask you how old your child was, your daughter. My grandson, who's also 4, is coming to visit. He lives in a very, very different geographic area. He lives in Tucson, Arizona, and has not been east. I think he's only been east once. We have a lot of forest around where we live in Tunbridge, and my partner is part of, she's been a longtime member of the Conservation Commission. So when you go for a walk with her, be careful where you step, because she can identify just about every plant. And she was remarking yesterday that when our grandson comes, that, we're going to line up some sort of planned activities and maybe go to a movie or go out somewhere else other than where we live. We don't leave home that often. But walking through the woods and starting to identify plants. I know the last time he was here, he was very young, and there were a lot of Fs out there. And, of course, vernal pools are getting ready to really get pretty active. So we thought, well, that would be fun for everybody, including a 4-year-old, we think. Just kind of walking around in the woods, and you're doing that with your daughter already. Is she, how sort of captivated is that? Is she really into it, or does her attention drift? At 4 is kind of an age, a lot of transitions going on.
A lot of transitions, yes. Yeah, 4 has been, for all of us, as you know, it's been a fun and surprising and, a sort of shifting age. But I think I have a whole sort of chapter in the book about Aspen and the red Fs in Vermont, and how, which was really an example for me of how, we're teaching her things, but especially in terms of just relationship to place, she's been such a good teacher for me because she just has such a natural, as I think all children do, just such a natural curiosity and a natural way of paying attention. And so I have a chapter in the book about how we were setting out intending to go on this big hike on the long trail, but it was red F season, and so we only made it about maybe a quarter mile over 2 hours because Aspen just wanted to stop and look at every single one, and it was a lesson in just, it was okay to just change our expectations and slow down and be grateful to see all of these beautiful Fs on the trail. And so she is into it, which is wonderful. And And she's so, you know, and it's fun. I think sometimes I get very serious about it, thinking like, okay, I need to learn these plants and I need to, you know, be doing it in this sort of intellectual way. But she's just out there playing and having this very natural conversation with the world. So I'm trying to learn from her.
Wow.
Yes. I think that is absolutely marvelous, the idea of learning from our children, because we put away childish habits, but we never stop being children, and we need to have the child in us awake and functioning throughout our life so that we can see the world in a new light.
Absolutely.
That's marvelous. You've been painting the picture of your life and how that is connecting you with nature and your children and seeing the world through them. Do you have recommendations for our listeners about things they might do more to feel more connected to nature and get personal as well as moving the world ahead to a better place?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and as we all know, I think this sort of the scope of climate change and ecological transformation that's happening right now can feel so huge and so overwhelming and so abstract as to sort of feel paralyzing, or you wonder sort of, you know, what can I do? And of course, I think, you know, we all know there's so many just practical things we can do, whether it's planting seeds or getting involved in local conservation, or I don't need to list all of those things. But this particular book is really about what we can do just in our own personal lives to start healing that connection between ourselves and the natural world. And I think one of the things I was so delighted by in writing the book was remembering just how accessible those things are, that even just remembering that we live in these physical bodies and how much information our senses are taking in every single moment, even if I'm not always tuning into that, we're always part of this conversation between ourselves and the outside world. And so just turning our attention to simple exercises like what we're seeing, what we're smelling, what we're feeling, and what we're touching. And then that's another way, as you said, just sort of that child's mind of being open and curious. And absolutely one of the things I learned from my daughter about is just how delightful it is to hear, just even taking a moment to listen to a bird singing outside, or to learn maybe even just one plant that's growing in your yard or in your local community that you don't recognize yet. And we can start sort of building this vocabulary of place, and just even those first simple steps are ways of deepening our connection and deepening that conversation with the ecologies around us. And I always have been lately thinking of Thich Nhat Hanh, this incredible master Zen Buddhist monk who did such huge, important work in the world, but he talks about how he always begins just with taking a breath. And so I think it can be similar as we're confronting something as huge as ecological crisis, to just remember that our relationship to place begins like right here with our bodies, and we can start. There's so much that we have access to delighting in and finding joy in, and finding places where we can start doing that work of healing and mending just really right within what we can touch. So that was one of my big takeaways.
Yeah. I know personally, my mind's always buzzy, and I'm thinking that if I concentrate on solutions, that I'll come up with solutions that are important. But that's all the intellectual side of your brain. And I think when you open yourself to nature and you just become aware of it, you take that breath that Thich Nhat Hanh talks about,
and just feel it coming in and out and what it tastes like, and you know, focus on the being there, that things open up that that intellectual brain doesn't ever access. I don't know how that fight, if you have any recommendations for fighting that fight, but I know I don't spend enough time in the non-mental thinking.
Yeah, well, I think it's so easy to overthink things, and I think, you know, I've gotten a little bit better at this, not as strong as a lot of people that I know, but walking in the woods and observing, and I'm just going to read this little phrase that you have in this description of your book. What if we could all mother the places we live and the beings with whom we share those places? Now, those beings, that covers the plants, animals, a lot of other living things, non-human. And what if they also mother us? And I get this is the feeling, whether I this morning walking down to a barn, I heard a pileated woodpecker. And the other day I could hear a barred owl distant in the woods. And then I saw an egg mass. And so a sensory appreciation, but also feeling like there's a reciprocity there of nature, not really through intellect, but just being nature is kind of mentoring or mothering the humans that are interacting with it, if the humans are open enough to receive that type of support.
Yes, I think that is absolutely true. And that was another sort of big learning process for me in this book, was starting to go a little bit deeper into some of the creatures I was learning about, and just every single time, you know, I wrote the book while we were still living in Maine. And so there's salt marshes and whales and then also these forests in Vermont where we came often before we lived here. But it's every time I went deeper into learning about one of these ecosystems, learning that they have, or even just a single species, that they have an incredibly important role to play in keeping the whole ecosystem healthy. And, you know, I think just, which sort of seems obvious to say, but as I was learning about things that otherwise hadn't really been in my understanding of maybe who was part of my community or who was doing this important work of keeping my community healthy, it was just, yeah, I think it was just a real eye-opening experience to understand that, oh, the health and well-being of my family is actually, right, it's connected to that pileated woodpecker who's doing its work in the forest. And so I think absolutely. And I think on that point of that intellectual and sensory, you know, the parts of ourselves that can feel like separate parts, I think another just learning for me that will continue beyond writing this book is just how kind of building that foundation of physical relationship. And then of course the intellectual piece comes in, because we then decide, okay, what can I do? What can I learn about? What can I start to implement in my own life that is feeling like it's responding to that sensory relationship and that deepening sense of place as well?
Well, thanks for bringing into the world this book. We have been speaking with Chelsea Steinauer Scudder and her new book that she just sort of presented last week in Rochester, Mother Creature Kin. And I really appreciate your perspectives, Chelsea. I'll turn it back to Henry before we say goodbye.
Yeah, so we need to have classes in this. I don't know how we organize that. I guess that's part of what we do on Green Zine. We investigate these things and try to. But I think kind of one-to-one dialogue and sitting with other people and opening ourselves to nature is such a valuable exercise to have be part of our daily life rather than a very occasional moment.
Absolutely. And I think I'm still a learner too, of course, and I will be for the rest of my life. And one of the things I'm most looking forward to as this book comes into the world is exactly those conversations and how we can learn from each other to keep doing that work.
Yes. Thank you so much. So we're just for your reference, we're going to go on and we're going to get into some of the pushback things, which are kind of in your head, for trying to put pressure on not having the Republican push to just mine forests and log as much as possible, kind of a drill baby drill approach to forests as well. And also tomorrow, something you might be interested in, I guess you're not where you can go to it, so you'll have to, but if you went into our show notes, you'd be able to see an interview that you could listen to about this. A guest we also tried to have on today is the author of Tree Keepers, The Race for a Forested Future.
Her name is Lauren Oakes, and she's going to be speaking. Henry, you probably have it in front of you. Is it tomorrow afternoon down at Dartmouth?
It's tomorrow at 2:30 at Dartmouth, and it's in the show notes. It's 2:30. It's free, open to the public. It's in Steele 006 at Dartmouth College, 36 College Street. Anyway, it's in the notes.
Yeah, we like talking about trees, Chelsea, on this show, so I'm glad that you brought that up extensively in your book.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. So.
Well, thank you both for the good work you're doing, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to have been with you today.
Okay, we appreciate you.
Please stay in touch, and you can find us on the web and actually poke through and see what our last year's worth of shows has offerings for.
That's wonderful. I absolutely will.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye.
All right, Henry, we've got about 8 minutes left in the show. You mentioned some pushback. Did you have something specific? I've got so many links here.
I think there's two things that are important. So so contracting our people in the in Washington, because there is this bill that Senator Shelby, Republican of Montana, Chris Curtis, Republican of Utah, Padalia, I think is his name, Democrat of California, and Hickenlooper.
Hickenlooper. I know of Hickenlooper.
There we are. So
I was surprised by him signing on to this bill. That's not a good thing.
I am surprised.
Yeah.
So it's the introduction of a version of the Fix Our Forest Act. And at least according to Standing Trees, it's all about just ripping into more and more forest and using up as much as possible for the immediate, basically the immediate cash gain that could be done from without regard to the services that forests are providing. So that's in the. That's in the notes, and you can access that. There are links to those things, and it's very valuable. Even if you think that our congresspeople are all going to be against this bill, it's very valuable to have made contact, and a phone contact, just leaving a message with them, is way more powerful than an email, unless you write quite a long, detailed email. And they're able to hold that up and say, hey, I'm getting this message from my people. And it also means that they'll pay a little bit more attention to it and try to figure out how to fix it. So there is a link to send a letter, and you click on it, and it'll take you to their addresses and allow you to do that. So we also have Standing Trees and they are they're doing a an event, and I'm just casting. I have that event somewhere, but I don't have the date and time of that. But I have the link to it, and they are they're trying to I think support that House Bill 276 that Todd referenced earlier, which basically is saying, hey, we need to have stop actively logging our public lands and start trying to have more forests become older forests. And I've spent time out in the Pacific Northwest, and it's a tree farming operation. And so what you see out there is forest, but it's just a little strip by the road. And then behind that, there is clear cutting going on. And Standing Trees is looking at the clear cut that was just done in the New Hampshire White Mountains National Forest. And it's pretty not much left behind, just debris on the ground. And that's not good for the environment. Yeah. So,
you know, I'll just, since I've got it in front of me, I don't have that date either, but I think we should pass this along. And, you know, we're very lucky in this part of Vermont, and I'm sure in other parts of Vermont as well, that we do have a lot of environmental activists who put their name and put their energy out there. And one of them actually is a whole family. We know Dee Gish, who works over here at the law school. She's written some very powerful letters to the editor over the last several months. Her son, Chris Gish, who is involved with Standing Trees, he is urging you to get involved on this Vermont Wildlands Act, and he has put his email. If you want to find out more about every other week meetings that happen on Tuesdays, it's an easy email to remember. So here's where you're literally connecting with a young person. I would guess that Chris is in his mid-20s, mid to late 20s, a graduate of the University of Vermont. It is simply his email. If you want to learn more about getting involved with Standing Trees, cgish, that's G-I-S-H, at standingtrees.org. And I think Henry's probably going to have that in the notes. I'm looking forward to reading some more of the details of the Vermont Vermont Wildlands Act in my spare time, if there is any.
Yes. If there is.
Yeah, if there is. If I'm not walking around in the woods, which is pretty fun, too.
Well, I was going to say, you got to have some and something. It's no good standing there looking at the headlights all the time.
Yeah. Hey, do we have time to just give a couple tips about Earth Day and some suggestions being made by...
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. Actually, this is a government agency, and I don't always agree with them, but I think they make some good tips here. This is from the state of Vermont's Agency of Natural Resources. If you went to their website, you can get more details. They've got a number of things for all of next week, Monday, April 22nd, right on through Friday, April 26th, and we still have a minute and a half to go. So they're urging you on Monday to think about things like compost, and they do have a Compost with Confidence guide at the ANR site. Also mentioning their pamphlet on Vermonter's Guide to Recycling. Buying lunch, order meals for here on Real Dishes, or bring a reusable plastic container to get meals to go. Well, I think that Carol Langstaff would definitely agree with that. Just don't get extra packaging. Stay away from extra packaging. So a number of other things under Monday. Tuesday, they're emphasizing going out and fishing, getting some information from Vermont Fish and Wildlife. There's a list of great hikes that you can take, even in mud season, if you go to the Vermont State Parks. I like this one. Bike the durable surface of a rail trail, such as the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail from Morrisville to Cambridge. I'm going to leave that one right there and just take a moment to once again underscore our underwriters, and they include the White River Partnership, also Integrity Energy Solar Professionals, Solaflect Bale, Royal Trail Works, Upper Pass Beer Company, and a whole lot more. Henry, any closing remarks? Any idea who we've got lined up for next week?
No, next week is still in the head scratching category.
Okay, I've got an idea or two that we can discuss afterwards, maybe in another day or two. So thanks for joining us here at WFVR LP South Royalton. You've been listening to Green Zine. Stay tuned for Democracy Now.